I didn't start applying for jobs until after I graduated. Right? Some of my classmates who had people who could advise them or tell them to do differently were applying for jobs while they were still in school, like during the semester. I didn't do anything until the end. And I didn't know, and nobody knew that the recession was going to happen. So I think those kind of things are kind of important for why you need to have people who can provide you with information so you can make better choices. Now, I don't know if I'm sure people, the generation after us, are a lot smarter than we are. But the reality of the situation is that if you haven't gone through that experience before, you don't know. And you don't even know to ask.
Is Assorted Immigrant Stories podcast. My name is Zenith Mwangahamambamalao, and I am your host. And for those of you that are stopping by for the very first time, this is a podcast about immigrant journeys, the things I and others wish we knew. We have interviews and share conversations with immigrants from diverse backgrounds and countries as they share their own immigration stories. We explore struggles, triumphs, and cultural adjustments. We discuss identity, belonging, and community, and we also highlight successes and contributions to both American society and back home, and that's wherever home might be. We also review some books that touch on the immigrant story. So don't forget to rate and review, like, share, and subscribe to wherever you get your podcast from. Welcome to another episode of Assorted Immigrant Stories podcast. And today we have with us Kola Wole, aka Kola. He is the host of Better Informed Immigrant Podcast. So be sure to follow him, and more on that later in the episode. Kola, welcome. This is such an honor. Can you just introduce yourself to our audience?
Hey everyone, my name is Kola, and I am one of the hosts of the Better Informed Immigrant Podcast. And I'm so glad to be here to speak with Zen. Although I've been calling her the Japanese lady, so we have to change the name.
Absolutely. So today we're going to take a listen to Kola's story, his journey from America to Africa and back, and what challenges he and his families might have faced, and just to see what we can learn from that. So, Kola, before we get started, this name, what tribe is it from?
It's Yoruba.
It's Yoruba. How do I say hello in Yoruba?
Bawoni. Bawoni.
Bawoni. Bawoni. And you know, I should know this because my son is half Yoruba.
What is your son's name?
So my son's name, his Yoruba name is Adeya. Adeya. So he's Malik Jipego. Jipego is a Tonga name from Zambia. And then okay. Adeya. Yeah. And then okay. His last name. Yes.
Oh, awesome. So you didn't tell me that you're already half Nigerian. Yeah, half Nigerian, half Zambian. Japanese.
Well, it's not Nigerian because remember, so you're from Nigeria and you guys have neighbors. So it's Yoruba, but it's from Benin.
You know, we claim them too.
You claim them too. And on that note, can you tell us where Nigeria is on the map for those that might not know?
Okay. So Nigeria is on the West Coast. You know, Africa is kind of like a number nine, the figure, right? So yeah, in that corner where the curved part meets the down part. That's where Nigeria is. And our neighbors, if you go further west, it's actually Benin. And then you go Togo, and then you go Ghana. But if you go to the right, it's Cameroon. so that we are nestled around that area. And I'm sure most of you have heard of Nigerians before, right? You're usually the loud people in those spaces.
Actually, you know what? I always say I need to do an episode that speaks to the Nigerian hustle. Because Nigerians are everywhere. And almost always, for me, people when people hear me speak, they first assume that I'm from the islands. And when I say Africa, the first country they always say is Nigeria, most of the time. So I liked what you said about the nine and where it meets to describe where Nigeria is on the map. Because you realize that you know the countries, but you don't quite know where they are. So I think you share borders with Chad as well. Chad and Niger, I think, to your north?
Yes. So on the north, yeah, we share borders with Chad and Niger. You are completely right.
Okay. And so do you know anything about Zambia?
To be honest, no.
Okay.
you are the second Zambian person I've ever met, I think. So I was really excited to meet you because the other person is also a young woman. Well, she has, I call her my sister. She has like three daughters now. But we never really spoke about the experience growing up in Zambia, right? We kind of were in the same social circle and things like that. So. I'm really excited to be here and to speak to your listeners and also to learn a little bit about Zambia.
Wow. Okay. That's interesting. So I always say one of the seven wonders of the world is in Zambia, the Victoria Falls. Wow. It's also called the Mossi Otunia, which means the smoke that thunders.
Okay. That's awesome. The smoke, that because of the effect of the water hit, like the splash.
Right. Okay. Right now, currently, we've had droughts because of maybe global warming, the weather. It's been a little bit difficult. So it's been a bit dry, a common tourist destination. Some people view it from Zimbabwe. They say it's the best view, but it's actually in Zambia. So you can also visit and view it from Zambia.
So I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know that this is a tourist attraction. But do my Zambian brothers and sisters actually go and see this stuff? Or do you just rely on tourists to go and see them?
It can be expensive. Mm-hmm. So there are things I've also just realized as I've grown up. So for us, for example, I went to a school where every time you got to sixth grade, they sent you to these national parks and to explore this. So I thought many people do that. And it's like, come on. But you realize, okay, I guess I grew up with a degree of privilege that I might not have really appreciated or realized until later. Because, yes, the majority of the people, that's kind of like a luxury. Even though things are changing, there are a lot more places with like waterfalls or where people can go. But these places have like, what, beautiful resorts, and they are expensive. And it does cost a lot of money to go. It's not just like everybody's, not, you know how it is here where anybody can go anywhere. If there's a national park, there's a something, you really don't have to be in a certain socioeconomic class, kind of. Maybe things are a bit more open to everybody, whereas yeah, back home it might be something that a few people in Zambia might enjoy. So they might be a lot more people who come from outside than the ones inside who go to enjoy the tourist places.
Okay, so you guys are truly African, right? Because that is something that is common for Africa. Anything that is ours is always more expensive for us to use, but it's readily accessible to foreigners.
Yeah, it is. And I think I know there have been talks with the Minister of Tourism to sort of try and change that. So it's changing that where the costs are not that high, but it's also for ourselves to appreciate those things. Because there's also that part where we ourselves, you know, when you have something, you really don't appreciate it. It's something that's just there. And then you step outside. Even for me, it's only when I stepped outside of Zambia, I started to say, well, wait a minute. You know, we have this thing and every presentation involves the Victoria Falls. Every presentation involves how we were once the second largest producer of copper, you know, second to Chile. Every presentation is like, yeah, but when I was there, it was just something, you know.
I had the opportunity to visit Ghana recently, and they had an interesting concept where for some of the tourist parks or museums, it's very, very cheap for Ghanaians but it's more expensive for everybody else. All right. So that could be a model that could work as well.
Actually, now that you've mentioned about Ghana, I've just remembered something. Last year, I was in Zambia, and there were different rates for locals and foreigners. So anytime you try to book for something, there was a sheet with prices, and there was the rate in kwacha, and there was the rate in dollar, and I had to produce like my national card, like for the country. That way we could get the local rates. But even then, it's still expensive. It's not something that because it's a local rate, somehow it's like, it's much cheaper than it is for the tourists, but it's still on the expensive side. So I guess we are working on something. Okay. So Kola, tell us about yourself. So you were born here in the United States of America. How did your parents find themselves here?
So my parents came here for college. To be honest, so the way I understand the story is that my parents met in Nigeria, in Lagos, Nigeria. I think my grandfather on my mother's side and my uncle on my father's side were colleagues at work. So their houses were kind of next to each other. And when my parents met as a result of that, and there was some romantic interest, I think the families were a little concerned about that. So decided to send my dad to Italy for school. And my mom at the time was in high school, but they sent her over to England to finish the equivalent of high school, secondary school. And then afterwards sent her to the US. What they didn't know was that when they were in college, my dad, who was supposed to be in Italy, moved to the US. So they were both in the US and continuing the relationship that the family thought they had done something about. So a few years later, they had me.
Okay.
And I was born in Connecticut, which is on the East Coast of United States. It's kind of close to New York. If you're talking about New York City, depending on where you're going to in Connecticut, you're probably less than an hour or a little bit more than an hour to get to Connecticut. So that's kind of where I was born. And when I was four, the family, you know, my parents had finished college at the time or university, and they decided they wanted to move back to Nigeria, right? That was always their plan. We're going to finish, come here for school. We're going to go back and do other things over there. So the whole family, it was myself. And at that time, I had a younger sister. So we all moved back to Nigeria.
Okay. So you probably don't remember that first 4 years of your life, right?
Not really. There are parts, you know, there are parts that I remember. And there are parts that have been told by my parents, you know, some of the funny stories that happened. But a lot of the experiences, yeah. So I'll give an example. So at the time, in the US, when you are very young, you go to kindergarten, right? That is before you start school. And, you know, I went to kindergarten, and there was this day when I came back home, the cops came with me to meet my parents, right? They had asked us in school, what did you guys have for dinner last night? And I replied, black stuff and dog. Right. So the cops came with me like, you know, what's going on? Child abuse. What happened is that I had amala. For those of you that don't know, amala is like for food, but it's black. And I had goats with the amala. And I didn't, you know, I called it dog. I didn't know that it was goats. Or right. I was very young. This was like probably 3 years old at the time. So, you know, my parents had to explain that the black stuff and dog was not like feces or dog. It was amala and goat meat. So those are some of the stories that we kind of have here in the US, right?
Oh my God, yes. Because of the differences, the food, and people don't understand.
Yeah, like, if I said hamburger, it would have been easy.
Right,
so
right.
From the American diet that I didn't understand it, and I was eating it, right? I loved it, but I didn't understand. I was too young. And Obviously, when I told that to my teachers, they called the cops really quickly.
Like, what kind of abuse is going on here? We need to find out. Wow, that's so funny. So you moved back to Nigeria. You're 4 years old. Tell us a little bit about your childhood then in Nigeria. Like, where were you now going to school? And just what was life like playing and stuff like that? What games were you playing?
Oh, so growing up in Nigeria, I enjoyed a lot. We were in Lagos, primarily. And I went to school in the capital area of Lagos called Ikeja. There was a school there at, called Christland. I first went to that school. Also because my uncle that I talked about earlier, that sent my dad to he had kids my age as well, and all of the kids were going to that school. So I went to that school for a few years, and then I transferred over to a different school called St. Leo's, which is a Catholic school, also in the same region. It's probably like maybe 2 kilometers away. And that's where I finished primary school. It was different, right? I was young, so, you know, the experiences, kids don't know any better, right? So I was very adaptable. I didn't necessarily feel that I had any challenges. I was treated differently, right? I mean, people tend to do that because of the fact that they say, oh, you're from the US, you're not fully familiar with our culture. So you have to take that time to assimilate. But it was a very good experience for me. The sports in Nigeria is soccer. Even when we didn't have a ball, we would play with oranges, we'll play with tangerine, we would play with limes, right? We'll play with rocks. It was soccer primarily. So that was the main sport. Sometimes we'll play like hide and chase and things like that. But that was the main experiences. Let me tell you this story.
Uh-huh.
Is that in Yoruba culture, it's a nice thing for the family to be able to eat together. And the way you do that is you actually put that in big platters and everybody would, kind of like some of our East African brothers and sisters do. Everybody would dip their hands in. So we were at my grandfather's house. All of my cousins, you know, African extended family, all of my cousins were around. The way it would be is that the adults would be in one area, the kids would be in one area, and they made this big pot of amala, right? And for the kids, which I was one of, they just dished it into this tray. It wasn't even a plate. It was like a tray. And then there was soup next to it. So for you to dip your, you know, break a chunk off and dip it into that. All my cousins were used to eating amala. I was also used to it, but I didn't realize that there was degrees to how hot it could be. So they just made it. It was like it was very, very hot, the temperature-wise, I mean. So everybody's dipping their hand into this thing. I put my hand in as well. Everybody pulled their hands out with chunks of amala. I took my hands out without any chunks of amala because it was like, it was burning my fingers. So I was blowing my fingers like... Right. By the time I was done blowing my fingers and figuring out what was done with my hand, and I looked back at the tray to take a chunk of amala, all of it was gone. Oh my Lord. I was like crying. What am I going to eat? You know, they were used to that experience of, like, you know, they just made it. So they were used to eating things like that. But me, I wasn't used. I was so, you know, in Nigeria, I would say ajabota. It basically means that, you know, you eat butter rather than some of the traditional African food. So you're a little softer. So that was some of the experiences that I had.
That is so funny. So tell me, is the amala made from like millet? What's amala made from?
So amala is made from yam. Oh. You take lamb, you sun dry. So fufu is usually made from cassava.
Cassava, okay.
Yes. So fufu is made from cassava. And then I know our Ghanaian brothers and sisters, they will take the cassava and they will mix bananas, green bananas, not bananas, but green plantain. They will mix that. Yeah. But Nigeria, primarily, we don't really do the mixing of the green plantain. It's really just the cassava for us.
Okay. So, because the staple food in Zambia is also nshima. So nshima, but it's the same thing. It's just like fufu. It's made out of cornmeal. It's from cornmeal. But there's a certain part in the country where they do use cassava as well. But it's a little bit different with the gari. When I buy gari here, gari is cassava, but it's different. The one back home is like very fine, but they make the, you know, the fufu out of that. So I wondered what amala, you know, came from, because it is dark. It's not like, you know, when you buy yam fufu at a Nigerian restaurant, it's like white, but it's like really dark. But people use it. They say it's healthier, right? It's kind of like as though it's oatmeal, oat fufu, or one of those things.
Yeah.
Like so dark colored.
Amala is primarily yam. You take, actually, it's only yam, but you take the yam, you sun dry it, and when the moisture begins to go down within it, what actually happens is it begins to turn brown or black. It's not black, it's more like brown, right? So that's kind of how it gets its color. We also have what we call pounded yam, right, which is the white of yam flour, not yam flour, but yam products. When you go to a Nigerian restaurant, right, you can get pounded yam. And that one is actually made with yam, fresh yam. You cook it like you would cook any yam, and then you take it to a mortar, and you now heat it to bring it to that consistency. It's kind of like mashed potato, but you're pounding on it. That's why it's called pounded yam, right? You're not mixing it like you would do mashup.
I'd never even thought about the name pounded, like, you know, what it meant or what it had to do with the pounding of the yam itself. Okay, that's good. So tell me, at what age did you then come back to the United States of America?
So I came back in 2001. So what happened for me was I went to Nigeria. I finished primary school. I went to secondary school. Finished secondary school in 2000. And the plan was, because I was born here, I think, that I was always going to come back and go to school, like college here. I think my parents had the thought that the colleges or the universities here in the U.S. were better than the ones in Nigeria. However, the primary and secondary school over there may be better than the ones here. I think that was their thought, right? And that was also their experience, right? They kind of went to school here and then went to the U.S. for college. So when I graduated in 2000, I was 15. I think my dad thought, hey, you're a little too young to go there. So he made me stay a year at home. And then 2001 is when I came back to the U.S. Now, my mother had come back to the U.S. a few years before I did. So when I came back to the U.S., I was actually coming to her.
Okay. So you came to her, and for her, what status was she in already? Was she coming as a, because the first time she was here as a student, right? So when she came back the second time, she came back as what?
So she came in as students the first time. But during that process of being a student, and before we moved back home, she had become a primary resident of the U.S., right? The specific system of what was in place, this was in the 80s, I'm not entirely sure about. But her status has changed from visa to primary resident. Really, it was when she came back the second time that she actually got naturalized and actually got the passport.
Okay. So for you, because you were born here, you were coming back, you're a United States citizen. So you come back to your mom. And at this point, have you decided to go to college? Have you decided what you want to do?
Yeah. So when I was growing up, I think the expectation is that you're going to college. So you had different mindsets in Nigeria, but primarily most people believe in education, right? So even though we have some of our challenges with the educational system in Nigeria, but it wasn't really a conversation about whether or not you're going to college. It's just you're going.
You're going.
So there was that part. The challenge for me was I didn't have any understanding about the system here in the U.S. In Nigeria, we have universities, we have polytechnics, we have trade school, but I've never actually heard of one or seen one in person.
Okay.
Coming back to the U.S., I had a few options. One was, because I was young, 16 at the time, one option would have been for me to go back to high school, right? Because in the U.S., people graduate high school at age 18, right? So if you are younger than that, you have that option of going back there. The other option, because of where we lived, was my mother wanted me to go to community college. All right. So I ended up going the community college route, which in retrospect, I think I should have gone to the high school. In retrospect, well, so there were a couple of different things there. Number one is neither my mom or me understood the systems, academic systems here in the US. And when you go to the high school here and you do well, you have the opportunities for scholarships and things like that for school. For me, I saw it as a way of going backwards, right? In our culture, you have this mindset that you don't want to go backwards, right? You're always thinking that my people that were my junior are going to be my mates, right? So we have that mindset, and that was the wrong thinking. So that's why I didn't want to go to high school. But I didn't know any better, right? My mother didn't know any better, so she couldn't necessarily provide me with information. And other people that were in our community did not necessarily know better either. Now, community college was fine, right? Community colleges is a good option here in the U.S. You can get to do your first 2 years of study, maybe a little bit more than that, maybe 2.5 years of study, and then transfer over to a four-year university if you choose to go on. But the problem with it is that you kind of need to understand the system there as well, right? It's cheap, but you're still paying for it, right? Because if I went to high school, I wouldn't have been paying anything, right? Usually the high school is a public high school, which is free. The other thing too is that because I wasn't aware of the system, the thing that I should have done in 2 years, I ended up doing in four.
Yes.
Right. So what happened for me is I went to a community college. I did what was called a pre-engineering science program. When I was done and I said, okay, you know what? I need to go transfer to a four-year university. I was told essentially, hey, like the classes you took here would not transfer into that program. You should have done this other program instead. And it turned out that the community college I was going to did not have that program anymore, right? So I needed to go to a different one for that program. So I spent 2.5 years at this community college, right? And then now I went to a different community college, spent another 1.5 years to do the classes, and then transferred over to the four-year university where I completed the last, I think it was 1.5 years, 2 years. So those are the kind of things that I didn't know any better. My mom didn't know any better. It wasn't a big deal in the sense that nobody was bothered about the fact that I had to do this. So there's this saying that people say about the journey from Egypt to Israel. Right. And there was a saying that the journey should have taken them 40 days, but God purposely made it 40 years so that the generation that lived in Egypt could die and the new generation can go into the promised land. So my point I'm trying to make with this is sometimes when you know better, that journey that should have taken you 40 years will take you 40 days. And for me, I ended up going the longer route because I didn't know better.
Yeah, no, that's very insightful. And that this is exactly what we're trying to do. That way people know, people have to do their research. It's not enough to just know, okay, I'm going to America, community college is cheaper. Okay, let me go to community college then 4 years. You really have to look into what am I studying here at this community college? What classes transfer to that four-year college? Go to that school, find out what transfers from that school, because this is where your right time is wasted. And I remember going to school for so many years because of such problems. You go here, you start something. You go here, you start something. Then you transfer to another college. Then you transfer back. And you're wasting. Well, I'm not going to say it's a waste, because today we've learned the lessons and we can share them and somebody can take a shorter time. So it really isn't a waste. But you look back and you're like, oh my God. Because even as you're going to school, you're paying, right? Your parents are paying, or you have a loan. And the longer it takes, it means the more money you have spent or the more money you owe in debt. So these are some of the issues that come on the back end. You know, when you're, you know, if you don't do it in an efficient way, so to speak. Okay, so you graduated and now you're an engineer, right?
I graduated from college. This is a while now. 2007, with a computer engineering degree. And then I started working for a company in Connecticut for a number of years. And while I was there, I did my master's part-time. So I did it in electrical engineering.
Okay. So, and before I get to the challenges that you experience in a workplace, I want to go back to another thing in college, because college, I realize, is one of the places you can network. And I listened to one of your stories, and I think you have something very powerful and interesting to share about internships, you know, networking with people and internships and how seriously people can take that, because all those are lessons we don't know. We're just going to school. I'm trying to go to school, pay, get out, find a job. Can you share with us your story about your internship and, you know, what you learned along the way?
Yeah. So, you know, I think platforms like yours are really important because sometimes you don't know what you don't know. And even when you know, you don't realize how important it is. So, again, I told you my experiences with community college, which I didn't know better. But I had similar things when I was in the four-year college, right? Some of my classmates were applying for internships and things like that. And I never did it. Like, internships, who needs it? Why would I want to go and work in the summer when I can be enjoying my life at home? I was privileged enough that my mom didn't require me to work while I was in school. So, like, I can enjoy the 3 months and stuff for summer vacation and then go back. My final year, I decided, okay, you know what? I need to get an internship. I actually got an internship with a company in Kansas City, Missouri. That was my first time getting an internship. It was actually a really nice experience. And when I got done with the internship, they actually offered me a job. Right? Again, I didn't know better. They offered me the job. There was a deadline for accepting the job offer. I think I probably threw the paper away somewhere or misplaced it. You know, I thought I would graduate from school. A job would be waiting for me. It would no big deal, right? We can just apply for jobs easily. What happened? I graduated in December of 2007. In the U.S., what was going on during that time was the banking crisis and the recession. All of the jobs I applied to, I didn't even get to an interview. They were just canceling the position, right? Because the economy was going down, so all of the companies were tightening their belts. And one of the ways they can tighten their belt was making sure they didn't hire new people, right? So I graduated in December. I didn't get a job until August the next year. Right? This is very, very rare, right? Because in the U.S., there's always jobs split, right? There's always more jobs than you can want. But because of a couple of things, number one is I already had a job offer. The money was good, right? There was nothing wrong with it, but I didn't know that I should take it seriously and actually accept a job offer while I'm looking for another one. The other thing too was I didn't start applying for jobs until after I graduated. Right? Some of my classmates who had people who could advise them or tell them to do differently were applying for jobs while they were still in school, like during the semester. I didn't do anything until the end. And I didn't know, and nobody knew that recession was going to happen. So I think those kind of things are kind of important for why you need to have people who can provide you with information so you can make better choices. Now, I don't know if, I'm sure people, the generation after us, are a lot smarter than we are. But the reality of the situation is that if you haven't gone through that experience before, you don't know. And you don't even know to ask. And you know the funny thing about this? One of our family friends is somebody that we used to go to church with. had asked me while I was in college if I wanted an internship with the company he works with. And I said no. Right? That person should have gone to meet my mom and have the conversation, not me. I was offered internships. Like, I didn't even need to work for it. I just, you know what I mean? Oh, my Lord. So, I look back now, and I am incredibly blessed. But I look back and I see that I've made so many mistakes. And it is my goal that my kids will not make the same mistakes, right? Because I will provide them with enough information so they can make better choices.
This is so true. And you don't know. And you're just thinking you're taking the right steps and you're not. But yeah, very important when you're in college, network. Because when you're looking for those jobs, it's those very networks you're going to need in the future. Yes, here in America, you have to network. It's just your performance doesn't speak for itself. Like, it's not going to help you that alone. And also volunteer. When you volunteer, you're meeting people, you're getting business cards. And when you start looking for jobs, those are the people you're going to call. It happens. So, and apply for a job, like you say, before you graduate. That way, you're not waiting until now I have the paper. And then now you're wasting 2 years. But thank God for you, you had your mom here, you know. But when you don't have anybody, if you were the first person to come, this is where you can become homeless, really, or going from one place to another, and then you're not welcome anymore because you can't help pay the bills. We know the lifestyle here. Those things can be very challenging. So what was it like for you getting a job? Because you are American, but you're also still Nigerian, right? You present as a Nigerian and as a Black man, but you're American on paper. What was the work culture like? Are there any adjustments you had to make? Or what are the things did you notice that you're like, okay, I wasn't expecting this, but this is the reality?
That is a really good question. I had so many challenges in the workplace, especially my first few years. And even now, I still have some of those challenges. In the US, everybody calls themselves by their first name. It doesn't matter what your age is, right? You'd be 80. If your name is Tim, I'm supposed to call you Tim. In Nigeria, that is not okay. Age is pretty important. Right? For example, I have 4 younger sisters. When they call me Brother Kola. So they don't just call my name. So, and that's kind of how, you know, when I was growing up here in the US, when I came back, I was in a Nigerian immigrant community. So we kind of maintained those same norms and traditions. The first time that I stepped out of that community was the workplace, separate from college. In college, you're calling people professor this or whatever, right? So that's you're still maintaining that in a sense. Now you had people that were older than me, maybe 10, 15, 20 years, and I felt uncomfortable calling them by their first name. So I would call them Mr. This, Mr. That. There were a number of people that they hired during the same period. And I'm the only one doing that. So it looked a little different, right? The other thing too is there is a way that people have conversations here that is more subtle than the way we have conversations back home. In our culture, you are allowed to talk with your parents. You are allowed to disagree, right? They are still going to make the decision because they have that authority. But that doesn't mean you cannot give an opposing point of view or disagree passionately. In the US, when you're passionate about anything, it comes across as being aggressive or rude. Right? So that's something that's a little different in the workplace. I'm Nigerian. We like to discuss, argue, be passionate about stuff. They saw that attitude as me being aggressive or rude. And I was new, so I was trying to learn. And it's not okay for you to just tell me this is it. Like, explain to me why it is it, right? So those are some of the challenges I had. Also, another thing I would talk about was how we speak. I don't know if this is the same for Zambians, but when a Nigerian speaks, sometimes a Nigerian will say things in such definite language. But what he or she really means is, this is what I think. Right? So, for example, you and I may be having a conversation about the sky, and you say the sky is blue, And I say, no, the sky is yellow. Right? You say, no, it's blue. I'm saying, no, it's yellow. The way I'm talking makes it think as if I know. But in reality, what I'm saying is I think we are having a discussion to kind of address it.
Right.
Versus if two Americans were having that conversation, they will say, I think the sky is blue. And I will reply, I think the sky is yellow. So that those two forms of talking are different, and they see it as different things. So when I was talking about, you know, being passionate and discussing things and stuff like that, you know, I was speaking so definitively that it turns people off. When in reality, I didn't realize any of those things. I just thought we were having a conversation. So what I typically find is that the older generation at the workplace, they were so self-assured in themselves, they were not intimidated by me. But my generation in the workplace didn't necessarily enjoy being in my presence.
Okay. Because they feel like you're aggressive.
They feel as I'm aggressive or I'm rude or the way that I communicate. But I was really fortunate, to have some mentors. Like 2 years in my career, it was not going great, but I had some mentors that came up. These were white men, in their 50s and 60s at the time, and they really helped me, right, and showed, you know, let me be myself, but also showed me different ways of doing things. And that was really, really helpful for me. But even today, I still have those challenges, right? That's life.
Yeah. So I went to a conference about 2 weeks ago now, and I was very interested to find that there was a class called Home Away from Home. So this is specific to nurses, because I am a nurse. There are these agencies that go abroad to get nurses from Africa, from Zambia, from, you know, all over Africa. And I liked what they were trying to do, because they recognize that because of the different ways in which people talk, it does create misinformations and miscommunications and biases, or where people think, oh, when people come, there are people here who think, oh, they might not know what they're doing, but it's just because of the way they're communicating. It doesn't mean they don't know what they're doing. So what they're trying to do is sort of bridge that gap to educate the people here, like, look, this person who's coming here, we know that they're competent. We vetted them, and that is why they're here. So when you hear them speak this way, this is what they mean. So I thought that was interesting. And I was like, huh. Because when I inquired, they were told, no, we never really had anything like that before. So people just come. And then you have somebody from here training somebody from a different country. And then the person might be reporting saying, I don't think this person knows what the job is, but it's because of that barrier in language, like you said, what you speak. I was also shocked recently when somebody said, oh, no, we know Zenith is nice, but she just comes off very assertive, but she's nice. I was like, oh, I didn't even actually, the exact words were, she sounds like she's reprimanding you. I was like, oh my God.
It's funny you're saying this, because that is a key problem. But for me, my parents, my mom specifically, not my dad, my mom has told me that I come off, she says, she used the word harsh, right? So if my mom is Nigerian, right? So if she thinks I'm coming off harsh, it's a little different than how somebody who is American would experience it, right? And to me, it's not that I think I'm like yelling now. I'm not yelling over you. I'm not kidding. It's just the way that I speak. Now, another African is not intimidated by it, right? But they have no issues. They understand we're talking, we are passionate, you know, we are loud, we joke, we laugh. But the white person don't have that context, right? And I hate to say this in a way that I'm going to say it, because it's not necessarily 100% right. But most Africans are privileged enough that they have not needed to leave their country. They have not even needed to leave their own community for where they grew up. So when they are meeting you, they're using that frame of reference.
Right.
And that is different from how the rest of the world operates. Right. when they see two Africans talking and we start yelling at each other and stuff, and then we laugh 2 seconds after, they cannot understand that. They said, oh, you guys were just fighting a moment ago. What happened? Well, they didn't realize that for us, the yelling was nothing. It was just banter.
Banter. African banter. Anyway, we keep moving and we keep learning. Because, I mean, people should be themselves, but you find yourself bending and cord switching because you have to fit in. People have to be able to understand you. So those are kind of some of the challenges that, you know, we face in the workplace. Right, so let's talk a little bit about your podcast, A Better Informed Immigrant. What inspired you to do this and what is it about?
Before we talk about the podcast, I just want to add one little thing to what we talked about before. One thing we also need to discuss or think about is how that same concept applies to people of the same color type, Africans and African Americans, right? Because I found it when I first came to this country, or came back to this country, I should say, I found it easier to relate with white people than I did with African Americans. And I think the reason why, after reflecting about it, was that when I see somebody who's white, he or she sees me, and we know we are different. We can see by our colors of our skin that we are different. So we give each other a lot more grace and tolerance. But when you're dealing with an African American, before you even say a word, right, your skin color is the same. So you think that you guys are the same or close to one another in mindset. So when there's friction, you don't have as much grace and tolerance because subconsciously you've said, hey, we are the same. So that friction gets magnified a little bit. So I think that's also something to be aware of. Like, these people are wonderful people. There's nothing wrong with them. But you need to think about that when you're interacting with them and they are interacting with you, to still understand that even though our skin color is the same, our experiences have been different, and we still need to give each other the same grace and tolerance when dealing with one another.
I absolutely agree. I actually have an upcoming episode sometime in the future with a good friend of mine, Ashley. I already invited her because I and her had many discussions about this sort of tension that you find when you come to America and you're like, my God, there's this gap between Africans and African Americans. I didn't understand it. I was very confused because for me, growing up, you know, you admire the Black culture, especially music, and you're watching all these sitcoms. And so for me, when I came, I was just like, wow, I'm going to meet Black Americans. It was very exciting. I mean, you're coming to America, and I will never forget, I was in a speech class where I was the only I was the only African person. There were four other African American students, and then the rest were white. And neither the white students nor the African Americans spoke to me, even when I tried to engage with them. And I was shocked, especially with the African Americans. With the white people, I just thought, okay, maybe it's just some, I don't know, racist stuff that we see, you know, or see on the news. But for the African Americans, I couldn't get it. And then I finally asked somebody else in a different class, and I was very shocked. And, you know, he went to speak on the slave trade and everything else. And, you know, we're upset. You see, it was the first time I was hearing of this. I had never heard of it before. And then, and with time, you start to see, it's like, yeah, they're groups, you know, we're separated. Even when I went to college, nursing school, when I look back, I went to what I'd consider an HBCU for coming to college. And so my friend who I'm inviting, because she also went to an HBCU, and she tells stories of, oh yeah, we were divided. We Black Americans were over here and the Africans were over there. And we joke, we say, okay, so how do we bridge this gap? Because truly, we're supposed to be close. We're supposed to be sharing information. I'm supposed to be telling you, honey, go to Africa and invest because you can come to Zambia. And, you know, instead of you feeling like, I don't even want to go there. And yet everybody else, the rest of the world is going there to benefit and to invest and to make money. But it's a lot of biases on both groups. Like, we have our own biases, then they have their own biases. And because we don't understand the histories, right? Like for us, even for me, it took time. I had to start understanding the history of the African Americans from, you know, back and to, until today, then you start to see like, this is why things are this way. But we should be like a family. We should be brothers and sisters. We shouldn't be apart.
Yes. I look to our Chinese brothers and sisters to give a model for what we should be trying to accomplish. When you see Chinese immigrants in this country or other Western countries, they still have that connection to the mainland. And the strength of the mainland is something that they benefit from. And the mainland benefits from their strengths here. Right? You're always seeing Chinese people doing businesses with their either with their compatriots in China, in Taiwan, in Hong Kong, wherever they may be. There's always this connection between them. And unfortunately, I think, you know, that is an area where we Black people need to grow in. And when I say Black, I mean the whole thing, right? I mean the Africans on the continent, the African diaspora, our Caribbean brothers and sisters, our African American brothers and sisters. And I know that all the Western countries have Black people too. I don't know what we call them.
But even South America, yeah. More, South America.
United and collaborate, right? To kind of make everybody's situation better. I wonder if there is any information or resources out there where you can provide like a set of YouTube videos as orientation for that are just coming into a specific country so that you provide them with that context. Right. And they're not coming in and saying, okay, you know, why are these people doing this? Why are these people doing that? They can kind of get a picture. Right. I'm sure there's a few books, so that may be a good idea to kind of explore.
Actually, yes, there's a book. I don't have it here with me. I know it was written by, I think his name is called Philippe Wamba, and it is about a country's journey from America to Congo and back. But he, like, just like you, he was born here, raised here, and I think he was mixed race. And it was those challenges where, okay, he was African American, moved to Africa, then he wasn't African enough. Then by the time he came back here, then he's not African. But I like that book because it really explores all these different groups as we're discussing. But it's one of the books I'll recommend on my podcast page. So it's very interesting. I was like, wow, yeah. He was like, okay, so where do I belong? What am I? You know, I'm not 100% anywhere. So, but I agree. A lot of work to be done. And you were talking about resources. I know there's somebody who was trying to start even conferences on this, like with Africans and African Americans in Colorado, but I forget the name. So if I remember, I will text it to you. And maybe we can try and find him and get him, you know, on the platforms so that he can speak to that and to see what he's doing. And that way we can learn a thing or two so that everybody's, you know, oriented to what is going on. All right. So now, and on that note, I talked about platforms. You have your own. It's called Better Informed Immigrant. So tell us about what inspired you and what it's about.
Yeah, so the Better Informed Immigrant is meant to be a resource for our African immigrant brothers and sisters to provide them the information to be able to make better choices. I just told you some of my mistakes, and I made those mistakes because I didn't know any better, but I also made those mistakes because I was a kid. And if I had somebody who could provide me with those informations, maybe I would make different choices. So it's a new podcast. We actually started this year and I'm kind of really excited about it. We kind of do it in two different flavors. Sometimes we talk about the topic. It could be personal finance. It could be spending money on social events on the continent. Or it could be an interview with an individual where we talk about their whole journey from the continent, how they came over here, what were the challenges when they first came up, and what are they doing now, and what do they hope to accomplish in the future?
It's a wonderful podcast. So obviously, I binge the show. So I do encourage everybody to listen in so you can hear to as many stories as you can. You know, we have many platforms and I think we need more people to do this. We need a million stories of Africans out there because there are many. Okay, so now if somebody is thinking about coming to the United States of America, what are you advising them to do there, somewhere in Nigeria and or even in Africa, anywhere, or even anywhere in the world? Some young person is like, okay, I want to come to America. What are some of the general things you'd advise them to do, at least before embarking on that journey?
So I think that question can be answered in different scenarios. If you are coming to visit, do that. You know, I think sometimes I'm not like a big planner or that kind of thing. If you want to go visit, short-term visit, whether it is here, whether it is the Europe or United Kingdom, whether it is somewhere else in Africa, go experience it. You know, enjoy the experience, learn a lot, network with your brothers and sisters. It will be eye-opening in that sense. Now, if you were coming here or somewhere else to make a better life, right? That means you are going to emigrate. Then I think that needs to be given some thought. I think there are two different scenarios for me. Number one, I always say, if you are doing well in Africa, then I would not recommend that you emigrate, because I've seen so many stories of people who were medical doctors in the continent or some banking professional or whatever, they come here and they're reduced to taking jobs as security guards, dishwashers. And the frustrating thing for me is that these people will not tell the people back home, right? Because people look at America or a lot of these Western countries as being better than our home country, which I don't necessarily agree with. So they have an expectation that now that you're here, you're doing well for yourself. And these people are maybe ashamed or maybe uncomfortable. They cannot tell the real scenario. I think we need to start having some of those honest conversations and saying, hey, this is not a bed of roses. There are opportunities here. There are also opportunities back home. And I think based on your scenario, you need to kind of look at it, whether or not this is the right fit for you. If you want to come here for college to get an education, I encourage that. I think it would be good to experience the world, and you may end up staying here. You may end up going back. That's fine. And then there's a different category of folks. I'll talk about Nigeria specifically because I don't know how this applies to Zambia per se. But in Nigeria, we have a big unemployment issue. People have graduated for many years. There are no jobs available and things like that. So some people are looking for a way to make a better life. And in those cases, then I would say the first and most important thing is make sure that you come to whatever country you're going to legally. If you go in illegally, especially in the Western countries, it can be incredibly difficult. The other thing is, whether you're going to come legally or illegally, make sure you understand the scenario on the ground, right? You cannot know every single thing because you're not there. We understand that. But do not go without being informed. And that is why a platform like yours are really important, right? You need to understand it because it's going to be radically different from what you experience over there. And you are going to have to make different choices. Some of those choices are going to be, how are you going to eat? Right? So some of my Nigerian brothers and sisters think you come to the US and that's it. You can start plucking dollar from the tree, plucking dollar from the... No. You'll be surprised how many people are homeless in America. Imagine being homeless during the winter, below freezing weather. And these are not black people or only black people. These are white people too. So let us not make it seem as if, oh, this or that. So I think you kind of need to understand the scenario. There are different vehicles for how people come into this country. Make sure you understand your specific scenario, what options are available. The question I will also ask is, what do you have for a support system? In Nigeria, it is not uncommon for us to family members to live together. Or you know, you can show up at your uncle's house or your brother's house unannounced. Even if you are African here in the US, that's not something that flies. Right, I hate to say it, right? So some people will take you in for a time, but it's only a time, right? Because things are not easy, right? I think you kind of need to understand that, right? Don't think you can come here. You know, I was incredibly fortunate. I told you my mom was here. She had already paid the price for me. But the reality of the situation is that she paid a significant price for me to be able to enjoy the privilege I did. I have friends that came in around the same time I did, that came in as students by themselves. I have people that came with their family. We had the DV lottery at that time, so people were coming in at that time. I saw people that had their own medical practice in Nigeria doing jobs as cashier at dollar store. Right, because their family has to eat. Right, so somebody's going to have to pay the price, and I think that's kind of important to know. Right, and are you willing to pay that price? If you're willing to pay that price, then sure, come. But if you're not willing to pay that price, then just come and visit, and then go back. That's what would be my advice.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And then one question as well. What skill do you wish you had invested in Nigeria before coming back to the United States of America?
Oh, that's a good question. I never thought about that question before. I don't know that I would say. You know, I think maybe one thing I can think about would be networking. I'm not very good with networking. You know, I can communicate with people. I'm a social butterfly, as I call it.
Okay.
But when I'm not seeing you face to face, I don't have, like, I'm not going to be one of those people that will call you or maintain the relationship. No. I'm more of a face-to-face kind of person. So I came back when I was 16, and I wish I learned that skill, because I think it's really important. If you're a good networker, there are doors that open up for that. When I was growing up in Nigeria, and even now, it was not a do-it-yourself culture. What I mean by that is, you know, if you had problems with your wiring at home, even something as simple as the light bulb, it was not uncommon for you to go call an electrician, come and replace it. Right? Versus over here, because things are expensive, there's a big do-it-yourself kind of culture here. So, you know, I was probably a little too young to take advantage of this, but one of the things I would want to know how to do would be to learn some of those technical skills. Right? And that could be something as simple as, being able to cut people's hair or being able to repair cars or things like that. Because those things are skills that would provide financial resources for you. Right? So for me, for example, I would just, you know, my mom was working, you know, with me and my sisters, my work was working 2-3 jobs. I was too dumb to understand the sacrifice she was making at the time. But if I had some of those skills, I would have been able to make significant income that would be able to complement what she's making and maybe help her relax a little bit more, right? Versus the options I had would have been to go work as a cashier somewhere or there, and you're just making minimum wage, and you don't necessarily have the freedom of time. I know people that are Nigerian that all they do is help people repair their cars, right? They set their own hours, and they're able to make a living from that.
Right, right. Absolutely. Yeah. I also know many people who even something like braiding hair, for example. In fact, there are a number of people I want to talk to. I actually have a friend, she jokes, she put up her master's degree in her house, just sitting there. And we used to go in her basement then to braid her hair. And today she has a big shop. But I mean, that's a skill, you know, if you can, like before you come in, it can help you if you're a student and you have all these restrictions, you can't work, you know, braid people's hairs. I have sister locks, and the people who do locks stay booked and busy. Sometimes for 3 months, you can't get.
What you said is the most important thing. You'd be surprised how many billions of dollars Black women in America spend every year on health and beauty.
On hair.
And it's primarily hair.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, my sisters, when they were in Nigeria, they would get their hair done every week.
Huh.
In America, you cannot afford to get your hair done every 2 weeks, much less every... Like, some of this hair, you know, they just do the braiding stuff. It's like $300. So if you're a woman, even a man, you know, I know us African men, we feel uncomfortable braiding hair. I've never seen an African man braid his hair before. So
no, my loctician in Zambia is a man.
Oh my lord, if you have that skill, you are all set. That's the main skill, because my African sisters have to look pretty and they are willing to pay.
They stay booked and busy. My loctician here is actually American. She used to be an accountant and she quit because this is all she does. She just does sister. And she, like 3 months, 6 months, she's booked and busy. If you don't get your spot, you're stuck. You are stuck. Oh, this is good stuff. All right. So are your parents still in the United States or did they go back to Nigeria?
So my parents, my mom is still here. My dad is primarily based in Nigeria. He comes and goes. So comes and visits every... But he's primarily based in Nigeria.
Okay.
So we kind of have like both sides.
Okay. So before we leave, so what are you doing to give back to a community either here or in Nigeria?
So that's a really good question. I actually spent a year in Nigeria starting in 2022. Back home for a year. Lived by myself. I didn't want to live with family members, right? Because sometimes they shelter you. I really wanted to kind of experience the culture, see what opportunities and challenges are there to solve. And I was disappointed a little bit because all of the original ideas I had were not necessarily going to work, right? So some of the challenges is that the return on investment does not make sense. Right. If you're going to invest money into something, there has to be some return. And so that was one thing. The second thing, too, is that, you know, at Nigeria specifically, I think maybe things are too hard now for a number of years that everybody's thinking about what can they get right now. Right. They're not necessarily thinking, how do we get little and it grows? They want the whole thing right up front. And then when you add that into the corruption, you know, it makes it difficult to do entrepreneurship opportunities on the continent. So that's a little bit of a challenge. So when I came back from that trip, my plan was actually to kind of stay there. But when I came back and said this wasn't going to work and I was running out of money, I needed to come back and get a job. I said, okay, you know what? How can I contribute? And one of the things I was thinking about was really media. And I wanted to use media as a tool to connect Black people around the world. Because I think that we need each other to be successful. Right? The reality of the situation is that some people, a lot of people on the continent, in Africa, do not have disposable income that they can spend on an investment. However, you know, African people in the West have disposable income that combined together can be used for investment. And then there has to be a vehicle for how people are aware of those opportunities obviously they have to be vetted and things like that. So my primary thing right now has been focused on the podcast. That was the first way I wanted to start. Also because I was trying to reduce the amount of financial involvement because I'm not wealthy, not yet. So that was one thing. But the goal would be to do like an African-focused media company, right? Where we are kind of highlighting positive things in our community globally. That would be one start. And then we start looking for how do we now take this community that we've built to collaborate together to actually start doing projects on the continent.
The continent. Wonderful. Okay. So how can people find you? Any social media platforms that you would like to share?
So I do have social media. You know, for example, you could go on Instagram. It's called The Better Informed Immigrant. You can also find us anywhere you listen to your podcasts, including YouTube. I know different people have different feelings about social media, but we are everywhere. So we are on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, and X/Twitter. And again, we're on YouTube. I would recommend that if you listen to what we do and you're interested, reach out to us. That could be something as proposing a topic you want us to research and talk about. Or that could also be something like you coming on the podcast to have a conversation with us, right? And we are open to having conversations with folks in the diaspora as well as folks back home, right? So I talked about the entrepreneurship piece. If somebody is, for example, a real estate developer back home and is willing to come on and talk about some of the things that they do so that we can kind of highlight those opportunities for people and our audience, that would be fantastic.
Wonderful, wonderful. Are you on Substack as well?
Yes. So when you go to any of those places, I use Substack for like actually hosting the podcast. And that's used as the distribution channel. So when you go to any of those places, you'll see a link to the website, which is actually on Substack.
Okay. All right. Any final thoughts, anything that I might have missed to ask, anything you'd like to share before we leave?
No, I think what you're doing is awesome. I'm really excited to connect with you. I can see amazing things. I was listening to some of your podcasts and I was liking the angle that you are taking with those topics. I was teasing you before we started about your music and the graphics and how you're doing such things at high quality. I think one thing I want to talk about, I think is most important, is this. Sometimes when we think of Africa, we don't think of high quality. I am really excited to have met you and to actually see what you're doing because I think you are making sure that you are presenting information, but at a high quality. All of the production things are really good. And I know there are areas to improve on and things like that, but you're really doing a really good job. So really excited about what you and your audience will achieve in the future.
I thank you so much, Kola, because I'm out here thinking, oh my God, yes, lots of improvements to make, but it's good to hear that. It pumps me up. I'm like, okay, so I've got to keep going and sharing this information. And I'm also very excited to meet you, people like you. I'm looking forward to more conversations, whether it's on your platform, you know, panel of Africans in the diaspora. I think there's a lot to explore. So thank you so much for agreeing to be here today. And how do I say thank you in Yoruba?
Oh, you're testing my Yoruba knowledge. I don't speak it often enough. So thank you. It's Eshe.
Eshe?
Yes, Eshe.
So just Eshe? Okay, Eshe. Yeah. What about thank you very much?
Eshe gan.
Eshe gan. Eshega, yeah, no, I thank you. This was such an honor. And yeah, I'm looking forward to the future. And I think until the next episode, this is goodbye. So don't forget to rate and review, like, share, and subscribe to wherever you get your podcast from. All right. Bye. Kola, you can say goodbye to our listeners.
Oh, goodbye to my Zambian brothers and sisters. I am hoping that Zen is going to invite me to Zambia because I have to come. Now that I know of you guys, we are coming.
We are coming. We are all going.
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.